Hey guys, Industry Preview is just around the corner on January 28th and 29th. Our speaker list includes the top leaders of some of the most exciting and innovative publishers in the world. For instance, we're going to have a panel with Rich Antoniello, CEO at Complex Networks, Ben Lehrer, CEO at Group 9 Media, and Pam Wasserstein, president of Vox Media, moderated by Sarah Fisher, media reporter with Axios. In addition to that, we'll have key leaders attending from the marketing agency world, including Mark Reed, the CEO of WPP Group. We hope you'll attend. And if you do, you can use coupon code PODCAST to save $500. That's PODCAST, all caps, at industrypreview.com. We'll see you there.
Welcome to Ad Exchanger Talks, the podcast devoted to examining the issues and trends in advertising and marketing technology that matter most to you.
This episode is sponsored by AdsWiz. Later in the episode, Zach Rogers chats with AdsWiz SVP of Product, Eric Baru, about the growing opportunity in digital audio. AdsWiz Audio Tech Platform is the underlying solution for leading audio publishers across the industry and was awarded the Best Publisher-Side Technology by AdExchanger at our inaugural Ad Industry Awards last year. In addition, their audio ad buying platform and DSP, Audiomatic, is optimized for podcast buying and is used all over the world by leading agencies to create entirely new audio ad experiences.
Hey everyone, this is Zach Rogers. I'm the executive editor of AdExchanger. So China and Western economies are inextricably linked, ever more so, through trade relationships, consumer habits, economic opportunities, culture, and technology. U.S. companies increasingly look to China and work harder than ever to connect with Chinese customers as well as Chinese citizens and travelers while they're in the U.S. And Chinese companies are increasingly looking to the U.S. for expansion. Social app TikTok, owned by China-based digital giant ByteDance, is the latest example. It's mounting what seems to me the first credible challenge to the walled gardens in recent memory. And it's outrageously popular with teenagers. To help us understand China's impact on media, advertising, and technology, I'm pleased to welcome Humphrey Ho to the podcast studio. Humphrey is a trailblazer in cross-cultural marketing. He was born in Canada, worked for many years in Canada and in China, and is currently managing director of the U.S. offices of HiLink Digital in Los Angeles. HiLink Digital is the largest independent digital agency based in China with operations around the world. I'm really pleased to have him here. Humphrey, welcome.
Thank you for having me. Hello, everybody.
Humphrey is coming in off the red eye, but he's remarkably bright-eyed. I really appreciate you making the time on Little Sleep.
It's good. It will keep me definitely honest and very opinionated.
Now, you travel a lot. We were just talking about this. Could you kind of summarize your travel requirements?
Yeah. So, China being a face-to-face culture, I do go home to Beijing to report in on what's happening and to plan world domination once a month. Luckily, this month is Chinese New Year, so I get a reprieve. And I live in Los Angeles, and we have a New York office here that's been growing quite extensively, so I have to make it out here at least once a month. There is pretty much nonstop travel, and I am one major U.S. Airlines client for life, but it's not bad.
Great. So take us back to your sort of early years and upbringing. You were born and raised in Canada.
I was. So I grew up in Toronto. I was born to parents from Hong Kong. I actually spent a lot of my childhood in Hong Kong with them. My parents both being, they went back, if you will, to work there during the heydays, the 80s and the 90s. And so I grew up in an international school and a lot of friends all over the world as a result. I went back to Canada for essentially high school and then a college or university, the University of Toronto. I graduated and basically at a startup. I actually joined a startup at that point. Our professor hooked us a few of us up, and we were trying to navigate this new phenomenon called the Facebook. And the Facebook was consumer facing. And so if we could make the Facebook for businesses, wouldn't that be a $1 million idea? And it was. And so that was nice. We sold the business a few years later, right into a recession. And I went client side to work. I worked for one of my clients and happily was going to retire in the automotive sector because I love cars. And because of that, the first exposure to China really was obviously we had a lot of factories in China. One day they decided to buy us. And they said, well, you know what? You guys work in marketing. I was the senior director of marketing. We don't need marketers in local offices. You go to Qingdao, in the home of Qingdao beer, but also really what is a second-tier city in the east, in coastal China. And so I packed my bags. I went without any hesitation. I said, how hard can this be? And my first mistake in Chinese culture was made on the first night. The chairman welcomed us. I decided to be the brash North American that I was to shake his hand. You can't do that.
Oh,
yes. And so he had his hands behind his back. And then so he went to drink with everybody, clinked a glass. And in Chinese culture, you're supposed to clink lower. Now, they trick you as well. So they're supposed to, they deliberately go lower even though they're much more senior than you. And if you don't catch it, that
night
is
over. You have to respond
over.
Like in the moment.
Yeah, pretty much. And so I don't remember.
So he was testing you. He left you hanging with your handshake.
Yep.
And then clinked lower.
Yep.
And did you get fired that night?
Or no, I don't remember I have no recollection of the remainder of that light night. That was apparently the punishment that I got. And so from that point on, working at anywhere like Wyden Kennedy, although there were many 2 o'clocks in the morning, seemed pretty easy.
Great. So yeah, you from then on, you have worked in the agency world, is that right? Wyden Kennedy, yes. And you were in Shanghai for them? Is
yeah,
that right?
So I was at WK Shanghai. I was a business director there. My job was to build new business for what is a very American agency and to sell this thing called creativity that at that point the Chinese still didn't really quite pay for. Chinese clients didn't really pay for creativity. It sort of came as part of a package of big media buy or whatever it might have been. So selling pure creativity was my task, and I spent that was the best part of my life. I carry a lot of how to run an agency. I teach a lot of people how to run the agency today based on really, you know, what I saw around the people around me and Wydenisms, if you will, that that really shape how I see the agency-client relationship today. And I'm very lucky because I work in an independent agency at Hylink, and in sort of a Chinese way, we're also really, we stand up to our clients. We fight for the work. We believe that if you do the work, the money will come. Only shit work gets you fired. So that's kind of what's very formative for me in advertising. And also, of course, after having worked at Google in China and Google Shanghai,
job. Could you talk about the Google experience for a minute?
Yeah, I was also head of partnerships for Google Shanghai. So I was on the reverse side of the ad salespeople. So if they go sell inventory, I had to go grab inventory. So my job was the worst, probably, department at Google in China, a country where Google is censored, but has a big presence. So imagine Google sells you ads because it knows who you are. It's because you type things into search bars, you use Gmail, you watch YouTube. None of those exist in China. So data collection in China doesn't exist in China for Google. And so we had to therefore still sell ads. How do you do that? Well, luckily for us, we have many local partners like Youku or we had Baidu, et cetera. And through data exchange agreements, we're actually able to monetize their traffic for our advertisers, our global advertisers who wanted to target the Chinese audience. And my job was to strike those partnerships, figure out what it is they wanted internationally at that point. They were probably the first to go international tech companies, and they were setting up servers and they were doing a lot of work with us. And so we tried to figure out how to help them outside of China, and they figured out how to help us inside in China. So my job was really architecting a lot of data relationships. That was also, it showed me, if advertising shows you how to remain independent, fight for what's right, Google, through doing no evil, showed me how to scale things like a wildfire, which is a terrible thing to say today, but it allowed us to scale things 10x, 100x. And so I've applied both of those core learnings through my many years at those places to really look at how to run the agency today, especially internationally, because we're so well established in China.
Okay, great. We're going to come back to the platforms and their data strategies inside and outside of China. But let's continue with your personal CV and talk about HiLink. So for listeners who don't know, could you summarize HiLink Digital and what you guys do, what your service offering is, and how you engage with clients?
Mm-hmm. So HiLink is an independent international advertising and communications agency headquartered in Beijing. So we have 2,400 staff in China. We have about 100 staff globally outside of China. Annually, we're doing about 1.6, 1.7 billion USD in business. The goal really is, if you look back at every other advertising agency network, they're from somewhere. We each so happen to be from China. And we're expanding both with our Chinese clients going abroad, and also we're addressing the needed issue of having an actual large local player with infrastructure in China, and also a service arm and planning arm and execution arm next to our clients here in the United States, in Canada, in Europe, in London, in Munich, in Paris, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Could you share a use case or a client that, you know, you have maybe a longstanding or one of your longer standing clients and how you support them?
Sure. So in the United States, we're very proud to work with Brand USA, which is the de facto travel tourism organization of the United States. We work with 24 other destination marketing organizations in the U.S., again, targeting about 3 million people coming from China to the United States every year, and how to actually find them and make them want to stay an extra night, because that really helps with tax dollars, it helps with revenue, sales, et cetera. In China, we've worked with, we're best known in China for our automotive heft. We've been working with Shanghai General Motors and all of their sub-brands for over 10 years. We're also known very well in IT or the tech space. We work with JD.com for many years. But there isn't really an industry we don't cover in China. But there's quite a few of them that we managed to keep around for a while. So we clearly don't piss them off enough.
Okay, great. All right, let's jump into it with some of the big tech companies. Now, there's about five huge ones in China. And, you know, I'm going to sort of beg your patience with me because I have rudimentary knowledge. So you'll be sort of educating me while we hopefully create some clarity here around who the most important players are and how the balance of power is shifting.
Mm-hmm.
So Baidu for search, this is how I think of it. Mm-hmm. And then correct me. Baidu for search, Alibaba for e-commerce, Tencent for social and gaming. And then they own WeChat,
yes,
which is the immense messaging and social and payments sort of platform.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's Sina, which owns Weibo, which is the Twitter-like app.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's ByteDance, which is kind of the new power, and especially with Western audiences, it's been one of the big surprise stories in tech over the last 2 years, is ByteDance's app, TikTok, sort of having like breakout success in the U.S., where it's very hard to gain market share in social because of Facebook squatting on that category. How's my summary?
I think that's pretty good.
Yeah.
So
in
the beginning, there was really Bats, so Baidu, Ali, Tencent, and Sina. And then now we've got BBats, which is ByteDance, Baidu, Ali, Tencent, and Sina. The reason why we can classify them really into five major publishing holding powerhouses or tech giants is because they each share the 26 hours of online time a user spends between mobile and desktop, mostly mobile, every week. And basically, their user data is very unique because Baidu is indeed search, with obviously investments in things like ride sharing and food delivery, et cetera. But their core is search. You know, Alibaba is mostly the e-commerce giant and the payments giant, which is Ant Financial or Alipay. They're known for that, and everything e-commerce is them. And so user data surrounding e-commerce and their spending habits are all there. Tencent is the social giant. They do, you know, one actually small correction or maybe small nuance is the first tech things to go abroad, the first one we've picked up is sort of TikTok from ByteDance because it's made the news headlines. But silently, Tencent was actually the first ones to go abroad with gaming. You know, Arena of Valor, Honor of Kings, all of these are games, mobile app games that have hundreds of millions of users globally that generate lots of revenue for Tencent, obviously long before TikTok made the news, because gaming really doesn't really make headlines. most of the time. WeChat.
Right, they're individual apps, and mm-hmm. people use them in a private context, and maybe taken separately, they're not huge businesses,
yeah,
individual game brands, but if you add them up, they get really ginormous.
Oh, yeah. I think from a revenue standpoint, Tencent dominates global revenue abroad that brings that revenue back to Shenzhen, where their headquarters are, still today, even though, like...
And is that all mobile gaming apps?
Mobile gaming, utilities, WeChat is definitely helpful.
Yeah,
to have
right,
that many
of course.
People
so that, WeChat is about 1 billion users. Is
yes, right? Yeah. 1.1 billion as of end of last year. And WeChat now has expanded with global wallets. So in certain countries, you can actually make payments just like you do Google or Apple Pay, sort of locally with domestic currency. And so you know, their expansion is clearly a pretty solid path to monetization, both domestically in China, but also globally. Sina is Weibo. Sina also is pretty powerful in terms of, used to be powerful in video content as well. It's still very powerful in content today. And shows, and then you also have ByteDance, which largely known for TikTok, or in China it's called Douyin, and a couple other live streaming short video applications that they have, in addition to Toutiao, which is their AI-powered news feed, if you will, because we have Google Home here every morning, we go through our Google news feed. That basically Toutiao, which is owned by ByteDance, recommends news to you that you should be reading based on your browsing interest and stuff like that. And that's also tremendously powerful in China.
Specific to China.
Yes.
So Douyu, sorry, what was the name of the Chinese version?
Douyin.
Douyin. Okay. So that's the Chinese version of TikTok. And mm-hmm. TikTok has been adopted not just in the U.S. and China, but other countries. And mm-hmm. in some of these places, it has different names, or just have those two brands?
It's just TikTok and Douyin. So Douyin is the China version, and
TikTok
is
outside
global.
China. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Great. One thing you said before we went on mic here, we were talking a little bit about market share among these players and the competitive dynamics. Mm-hmm. Could you summarize that? I mean, they're kind of vicious with each other in ways that maybe Western digital platforms are more reluctant to be.
Mm-hmm. That's actually entirely correct. So imagine there are five city-states. They're clearly very well-walled, but there's roads connected to all of them. Mm-hmm. Again, the Chinese user, just like the Western user, has a certain amount of eyeball time on their phones and on their PCs. So a new player like ByteDance coming in and stealing time is the most biggest concern of the established players. That's like Tencent, who has a video platform. Tencent has a short video platform. Tencent has WeChat. They want you to stay there. They also want you to shop at JD.com. Well, Ali says, well, we want you to shop at Taobao and Tmall. And we want you to watch videos on Youku. And we want you to order food when you're hungry. So a variety of factors like that caused the original, the OG fight that made it into Western media was actually the fight between Alibaba and Tencent. When on WeChat, you could share a Taobao link, but if you click on the link inside WeChat, it would go nowhere. It was a link blocked. So that was the original way of going, well, you can't take my user away from me. Mm-hmm. And that's been pretty normal in China. There's link blocking here, link blocking there. Things don't load very properly. Mm-hmm. However, because Douyin has this tremendous social commerce capability, all the influencers are there. It's a very short video is the future of video, essentially.
Yeah.
And they do have AI powered because ByteDance invests a lot in AI. A lot of their content is shoppable. And so therefore, where do you shop it? Well, you can either shop it on JD.com, the largest B2C and also the second largest e-commerce platform in China, which is owned by Tencent. Or you can shop it on Taobao or Tmall, depending on the brand, the largest e-commerce owning 80% market share in China. So on a shopping front, they're friends. Best friends ever. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. However, don't take my user for the news apps, though. We're not going to let you share your news app content with my news app content. But mm-hmm. shopping, totally cool.
Okay.
And so that kind of war is selective, mm-hmm. But it's very prevalent in China because the user data doesn't flow from one to the other. They do not have the ability to collect user data from one walled garden or one city state into the other. unlike here. And also even like advertising agencies and other programmatic platforms, they have to collect a lot of attributed data simply because the publishers share certain portions of their data with us. And therefore, the sketch of the user is not as full as it is in the US. The data points are all very inconsistent.
Okay, let's talk about data. But first, let's hear a message. I'll be right back with Humphrey Ho. I'm here again with Eric Barrah, SVP of Product with AdsWiz, our sponsor for the month. Eric, what will be the big trends in 2020 in podcast advertising?
Podcast advertising is clearly getting to a mature state, but we still have work to do to reach projected numbers. Some of our podcast efforts are around mainly two themes. First, we need the industry to move completely to dynamic insertion, retiring the baked-in ads. This doesn't mean host rate sponsorship are going away, to the contrary. Leveraging dynamic ad insertion is unlocking additional revenue. You can now tailor your host rate ad based on location, interest, and overall objective of the advertisers. A podcaster can now sell several sponsorships at the same time, having, for example, an ad for a brand only interested in West Coast listeners run at the same time as one for a brand only interested in East Coast listeners. You're no longer wasting any impression, and you can further optimize. Second is actually creating audience buy for podcasts. We recently launched Podscribe just to solve that problem. Advertisers are looking for scale and simplicity. Podcast is great because we have hundreds of thousands of shows, but it can be tricky for a buyer to know where to buy based on the audience. Being able to classify content around topics and even more understand who listens to what will make podcasts an easy and scalable audience buy. 2020 will bring a lot around podcasts, and we believe that it's a big boom around it. We just need to make sure that we continue to drive innovation to the podcast advertising.
There's a lot of talk about brand safety in advertising as a whole. How does that apply to audio, and what is AdsWiz doing on that front?
Well, when you think about it, audio is kind of brand safe by nature, right? It's brand safe in the way it's produced and consumed. We have premium brands producing premium content. However, podcast is growing, and we're going to have more and more content on our hands, and it's on our radar to make sure that we keep this a brand safe environment. That's why we've gotten very good response on our partnership with companies like Comscore. We build a cost-effective way to transcribe any podcast into a high-fidelity text, which then can be analyzed and classified for brand-safe targeting. Our partners can then, you know, select and use any of the Comscore segments when running a campaign on our stack, and that's what helps keep a brand-safe environment and engage more and more advertisers on podcasts.
All right, thanks for your support. Okay, so we were talking about data availability between the platforms and then data availability from publishers to you, the agency, or the buyer. It could be the brand. You said that it's not maybe as granular as what you'll find in the West. The West data available in the U.S. is actually starting to shrink. Mm-hmm. And we may get to a point of obfuscation that looks a little more closer to what's available in China. But I don't know. You tell me.
Yeah, so it's interesting. Everything is... it's so conflicted in China. We have real name ID. We know exactly who owns a certain phone number or a WeChat account. We know who the WeChat account is tied to in terms of user activity. We know the WeChat account is moving around, the Tencent ID is moving around, shopping, gaming, etc. on the Tencent platform. In the Ali sense, we have Taobao ID. We know what they're shopping for. We know if they watch a video on Youku, but we don't know what he or she's doing on Tencent video. That does not compute if they do that. And users obviously go from platform to platform. They don't care which platform it is. They just care where the content is.
It doesn't sound that different from the US.
But the thing is, this amount of name data would be very valuable to buyers and advertisers because the data is essentially completely not anonymized. There's no anonymity to the data. So the amount of mineability is very high. However, because they live in different walls and publishers choose to share that data in sort of piecemeal, and many of it is due to, in China, buying leverage. If you are a large media agency and you have leverage, you will naturally have a strategic partnership and therefore an alliance and therefore the data pool that your clients need to analyze the data. And so a lot of it is tied to sort of three things. It's tied to leverage, so media size and media buying power. The second thing that it's tied to really is how can you detect identifiers or tags between different publishers and the data that they leave behind to sort of piece the user together as a different ID. So if you look at Taobao ID or Tencent ID, you have to actually look at the data points. And we've tried a lot with machine learning to actually figure out it's actually the same person. So we're not cannibalizing activity.
Any success?
Yeah, actually, we do a pretty good job at doing that in terms of sitting on a very large data set. I mean, Hylink being the largest media buyer in China, naturally, we sit on a lot of first and third party data for our clients. And so what we've actually developed is something called Hylink ID. So we've attributed data points to identify with a reasonable degree of predictability, this is the same user. And so we can actually find, then the media plan can finally come out. So we can target a user's consumer journey throughout the day or throughout the month or throughout a campaign period. That's left to the agencies to do. I mean, clients don't have that data capability. They have the demand of such. They don't bring any tools from the West that is worth anything for us to do that. And so most of it has to be house built. And so therefore, that is the challenges we experience in China, the plethora of data mixed with the actual data is really, really helpful, except it's only shared piecemeal. Certain publishers will only share certain tags or data points. And so it's very confusing to find, for example, some publishers, for example, that shall remain nameless, don't share time with us. So we have no data. We have no idea.
You don't know when the ad was served or the impression happened? Or
we have no idea when that user did this kind of browsing behavior.
Okay.
So you have to sort of attribute that somehow to login information that they may or may not give you on another app inside their same ecosystem. Mm-hmm. And so it's kind of fun. In the US, at least, we have data points that even though different publishers do share different data points based on what their core, you know, their core excellence is for Google or Facebook, but they do share a common set of data with the user that is mm-hmm. commonly anonymized. So it's actually pretty simple to figure out if that user is the same person, or at least you can attempt to attribute it. In China, it's literally figuring out first the data points dictate if that user is the same person, and you have to then rationalize to the client that you've got 75-80% accuracy. Mm-hmm.
Got you. Okay, great. So could you speak for a few minutes about the differences between the China marketplace and the US in terms of how advertisers and agencies work together, as well as how publishers and the agencies and the brands work together? You made a reference earlier on to how you didn't have unbundled creative services back in the day mm-hmm. as one example. But could you talk about sort of some of the unique dynamics mm-hmm. in the market?
So the first one is integration. Chinese agencies like us, when we go abroad, I had to spend a lot of time explaining to clients, we don't understand why media and creative agencies ever separated because we never had that. So from a Chinese agency perspective, when you go to China, clients are like, well, I need a creative agency, then I need a social agency, then an influencer agency. What do you mean? Digital agencies like Hylink have divisions. Oh, but you might not do everything well. No, because the second concept is known as leverage. If you have buying power, you can do anything well because the publishers will do innovation with you. They'll do something cool with you. So in 2000, and as early as 2013, we were able to take Bumblebee and a Transformer movie to bust through the Baidu search bar. Now, to do that, first of all, you have to have extensive media buy and you have to have a client like Chevrolet. But the publishers won't listen to you if you were just some creative agency that proposed that idea or if you were a media agency that had no idea. Mm-hmm. So you have to be both and you have to also be social, et cetera. So the second one is
what would be the threshold for how much money something like that would you need to spend to be in the tier where they'd let you really play with their interface and do creative executions that are special?
That kind of one ad spot in China, typically we evaluate it in the 100 million RMB threshold. Like how many 100 million RMBs is this? Is usually what innovation costs. So it's approximately 13 to 14 million USD depending on what day you check for one piece of quote-unquote innovation. So like, you know, McDonald's doing the go catch a melting ice cream cone, those kinds of things on Baidu Maps, those kinds of innovations mm-hmm. are pretty costly in mm-hmm. China.
Right,
but they build tremendous brand love and obviously there's massive conversion. Buyers do tend to like
that kind of thing. Used to be somewhat common in the United States on platforms like Yahoo and AOL.
Yes,
and it's really disappeared now. I think with platforms having just so many gobs of money,
they don't care.
They don't need to yield to kind of these kind of revenue opportunities because they're already going to make their dollar from 10 million small businesses.
Well, that actually goes to the third point of, you know, how are agencies very different in China? The third one actually is understanding the pillars of censorship in China. So an ad buyer cannot directly buy advertising in China without an agent. An agent is an agency because the agency is responsible to take liability for if the ad goes out there and it says something that violates advertising law. that claim something it's not supposed to claim.
Or
that
so is there some certification agencies get then from the Communist Party, or that allows them to operate as agencies?
Well, you need to get a business license, so you need to go apply for one, and you need to be an advertising or a consulting, information consulting corporation to be able to get that kind of license. But to media buy or to buy media, really, you actually don't need to have any kind of license, if you will, quote unquote. Mm-hmm. You actually, again, have to have leverage with the publisher and good relationship. Because China's very relationship driven. Even data is relationship driven. Yeah. You want more data? Well, you got to have leverage and media buy, and you have to know so and so.
Mm-hmm.
And so the leverage. In essence,
so small business applies to small, even the smallest of businesses, I assume.
They can try.
Okay.
And then publishers, just like in the West, like, well, you're too small, so you get to go to like this poor account manager who's got 100 accounts.
Gotcha.
And so they can still execute. So then therefore the market of SMB and LCS, they still exist in China. And there are, you know, account managers at these publishers that deal with that. As much as Tencent's gone gaming, most of the revenue now is gaming. As of mid-2010s, they basically made more money through gaming than they did in advertising. But they've never forgotten that you can do something fun on WeChat. Or, you know what, let's innovate this ad unit, because you know what? We can sell it to hundreds of thousands of other agencies. That's another common thing we have globally. And that ad unit can therefore be monetized, and it can be a new rev opportunity. They see it more as a monetizable opportunity, and publishers here and platforms here are giving way to simplicity, design, privacy. In China, the expectation of privacy has always been interesting because—
AKA doesn't exist.
Yes, it's free. First of all, there's a heavy culture of being monitored. And so therefore
everybody expects it.
You live at home until you're in you live multi-generational homes. Like, the privacy concept in Asia as a culture is also just so much less. And also when you add the concept of you've got, the content's clearly free. This celebrity in your content's clearly very expensive. Therefore there are ads. So the consumer is actually okay with that kind of exchange. Of course, I would like this content for free. Well, therefore I've got to suffer through 120-second pre-roll. That's fine.
Really? 120 seconds?
Or more. So, and even if you buy a VIP pack to some of these video platforms, you still get 15 seconds. Sometimes they slip it to you. So there still is that expectation. So as long as—
they expect to be sort of to have their data collected, it's not a problem. And then, but then the platforms themselves don't
share it.
So they really use it for their own purposes. And there's a government piece to this as well.
Mm-hmm.
And let me ask that question. So are these companies the tools of the Communist Party?
That's a very tough question to ask an independent agency that operates in China.
Right.
So I will also stress that we are not a advertising agency that is owned by the state or a state-owned enterprise. Many ad agencies, of course, are in China. We are not. So one of the things that we have as an advantage is we obviously have to obey laws and local regulations, but we don't have to be necessarily marching to the same tune all the time, if you will. I think many publishers inherently have to obey the law in China. And unfortunately, the law is written by a one-party system. And so therefore, some of the laws are unique in terms of data collection, in terms of data mining, in terms of censorship. I mean, publishers here, even though they do have sort of an approvals department, like Twitter or Facebook, they approve ads, et cetera, that might be flagged by the AI. In China, there actually is a censorship team. So they do like sort of note down what the office, the NRDC says that it can and cannot publish, what you can and cannot show for decency, et cetera. Certain celebrities that we don't want, or certain nationalities we can't, we're in the middle of a political spat with that have to be shut off. Those kind of things do happen. And as an advertiser, I can only speak from the fact that we are affected by that, usually more in the sense of last minute decisions. I can't speak for whether or not the five major owners are mouthpieces or how closely affiliated with they are with the party. But what I can say is if one goes on YouTube and they watch videos of People's Congress gathering, and self-information is very important in any culture, and you look at the attendees, you'll be able to see which ones have pledged loyalty and which ones are members. and make your own assumptions as to how their corporations are run based on our understanding of their management methodology.
Great. Thanks for fielding that question. It's more relevant now, I think, for U.S. audiences because of TikTok's market gains. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think there are questions about whether the Communist Party would use a platform like TikTok and its relationship with ByteDance to spy on U.S. consumers. Mm. And we've heard some U.S. Congress people voice worries about that. Setting that aside, I wonder if you could speak to the future of Chinese tech in the United States and also just like globally. Mm-hmm. It is the first time we've seen like an app that has, I mean, other than gaming apps owned by Tencent, mm-hmm. it's the first time we've seen one app just sort of penetrate, get into the tens of millions, I think.
And have social prominence, have pop culture sort of effect.
Yeah.
And actually like take over a segment where even our guys can't, like Facebook, Instagram can't catch up to, or Snapchat is actually looking at it.
Yeah.
That they would be the first app doing that. Because, I mean, gaming is gaming. You either game it or you don't.
Okay. There's so many questions I have about this. Let me ask just two.
Yeah.
One is, why do you think TikTok has been able to break through in the way that it has? Do you think it's AI?
So it's a combination of A, being able to serve a need of it started off with, just like Snapchat, a very young consumer. But the activities you can do on it and the curation of content that you can do on the site. So influencers are encouraged to start sort of what we call viral campaigns, or they do stuff that's actions or follow along with songs and all that stuff. Those kinds of curated content curation, I mean, guides a younger audience to go, hey, yeah, I could do that too. You can do that same dance, or you can do that same action. So I think that's been pretty successful. They've actually curated or encouraged their community to do that. So it's kind of like publisher-led community management, if you will. The second thing I think they've done a very good job is they've spent a lot of money, but good money, in targeting users for user acquisition. So it's just really just targeting user acquisition campaigns globally to acquire users.
And paid then, campaigns.
Yeah, paid campaigns. And then, and then the user comes. Mm-hmm. I don't think it had much of an effect to the reverse of what, you know, WeChat's strategy was, which is, you know, if we let WeChat permeate through the Chinese diaspora, their friends will use it, which hasn't really taken off. TikTok took a very active approach to getting you to use the content. The content was curated in the sense that things you could do on it and participate and record were suggested by the platform. And then thirdly, yeah, the AI takes over. I mean, like things that you can watch. For example, Hylink executed the Met Gala campaign online. That was served to, essentially, we saw the tags of people who like arts or culture, or who have watched videos of this and that. So they're able to serve the campaign that was related to promoting the Met Gala and the Met on TikTok very precisely to existing users. And so that cycle is pretty good.
Okay, great. And then do you think we'll see more Chinese tech gain market share with Western audiences soon? Is this a harbinger of like a wave? Because you do hear Silicon Valley types talk about AI, you know, the advantage China has just because of the sheer immensity of data. So theoretically, the largest companies are going to be able to use that data and their AI to expand and to build more sticky products that people want to spend oceans of time with.
I don't see, and we don't see, a consumer app or a consumer tech from China anytime soon that's going to have that massive effect. I mean, at a very much smaller scale, DJI drones from Shenzhen, they took a huge share of the drone and now the sort of mobile adventure video segment. But in terms of actual apps or tech, we actually don't see one that's going to easily port over. I mean, there are many apps that have come and failed. I mean, if you look at ride sharing, Didi, huge in China, 20% owner of Uber. They had a partnership with Lyft, and they didn't really succeed here, and Uber didn't really succeed in China. Lyft didn't succeed at all in China, never went. And so, did they try? Yes. Did they fail? Yes. Are we going to see hardware things come to the U.S.? Yes. I mean, we're consumers. We're going to buy things that are consumer-based. It could be the next drone or whatever it might be that we're going to buy from China that contains AI in it, sure. But in terms of like a wildfire-style, viral-style app, like TikTok, that really is sort of a really well executed one-off strategy. And I do want to comment on AI actually.
Great.
You know, people always ask about, well, will China win AI? There's all this AI. In China, you know, AI, the words AI, 人工智能, which is human art of intelligence, actually, or human working intelligence, is the same as human intelligence, 人工智能. So if you look at it from a Chinese word perspective, the only reason why China may or may not win the AI race of driverless cars, driverless trucks, or visual face recognition, et cetera, is people. China has armies. That said, not actual army, but actual people, farms and farms of people that have been, used to be armies of iPhone workers. They used to be hardware makers. They used to make stuff for us. In an evolving supply chain in China, where you need fewer people because of automation, you're actually seeing a lot of these people go back to a desk, but in front of a computer. And what they're doing is what AI really needs, which is the human side of identifying, is that a road sign or is that a cat? Is that a dotted line in the road? Is this a face? What color is the face? You know, what kind of hair is the face? And so where are the eyes? And so that AI is driven by humans. And so if—
So they're manually coding images and other unstructured data.
To structure it. Mm-hmm. And so the machine will learn. They're also basically doing human error testing or human test scripting.
Right.
And I think there is a component of that because you can't rely on a machine to learn a machine. I mean, that's the problem that we have in the West. And I think if you look at that as a whether or not they're going to win— They definitely have a lot more human power, and therefore they can understand. But in terms of like an app serving you news, that's not really, it's more machine learning. It doesn't really involve AI in the sense that it can actually make decisions. But I think things that make decisions like self-driving or autonomous driving, that stuff I think China's probably got a leg over us because it takes so much human power to correct. But in terms of simple push interactions that require machine learning, which is a component of AI, like serving you the most relevant news, serving you the video, you should watch this. I think that's pretty equal. If, in fact, maybe even the U.S. has or the West has a better hold on this because our data streams are standardized.
Okay, great. So one, I need to have a minute on influencers.
Okay.
There are real differences between the influencer marketplaces in China and here. Mm-hmm. Could you talk about those differences and how you see the China-based influencer ecosystem evolving? Mm-hmm.
So China last year went through a huge transformation in MCN or for influencers. So previously, you went to an influencer school. And then that influencer school may have had sort of a rep agency kind of repping you and selling you to different platforms.
Well, that's amazing right out of the gate. Like, it's so structured.
Yes, because it has to be... Well, it has to be that scalable, and again, it's all about who you know. The owner of the school or the owner of the MCN knows someone at Douyin or knows someone at Weibo. So your account, when you get famous, doesn't get
or at Hylink
or at Hylink, yes, that doesn't get blocked or the inventory. You don't lose inventory or you don't lose direct clients or you don't lose advertising accounts. They have to also monetize you on the other end with brands. So you know you went to a school for that. It's just not unlike going to be an aspiring singer here. You need to sign it with a good label. The difference of China is that last year, a lot of the influencers were basically signed back to the big five publishers. So it depends if you were a WeChat influencer or if you were a Douyin influencer or if you're more of an e-commerce influencer, you signed with one or both or many of the actual platforms themselves. So imagine if Facebook had a really strong MCN and you could buy influencers from just Facebook direct as you would buy an ad. That's what the publishers are now doing and in fact have successfully done so because, well, they control the inventory. You are creating inventory on their platform and therefore, if they don't like you, well, they're going to stop you.
Turn you off. Deplatform you, so to speak.
Yes. So they can do that. And therefore, the platforms have now become the MCN. So that's the first change. And the second change actually has been good is we're observing the sort of self-regulation. You know how our industry in advertising, it needs to first come from usually the client or it's the publisher. It's never the ad agency starting anything. We're always stuck in the middle. larger clients like luxury, automotive, FMCG, they're starting to actually demand, and this is a trend we predict will be very strong, much deeper lower funnel conversion metrics for even influencers, just like they would demand a landing page or an e-commerce SKU. They're now, for example, in China, very successfully, we ran a campaign for Estee Lauder. We sold, and we could track that we sold over 150,000 lipsticks in an hour for the pre-Singles Day event for Estee Lauder, because we had an influencer, very famous influencer and now a singer, and his job was to be compensated and partially shared in the profit of trying on lipstick, and he's a gentleman. So he tried on lipstick. It obviously creates a lot of impact when a guy tries on lipstick. Mm-hmm. It's also a very famous celebrity, so it's kind of like a little bit funny and a little bit lighthearted. And he can obviously, what we call dai huo, which is to bring the goods, which is to sell stuff. And so that shift.
So he sold 100,000.
In an hour.
In an hour.
150K in an hour. It's all tracked to him, obviously, because it goes through his micro store.
Uh-huh. Does he get like affiliate fees or is it not quite that? How are the payments to him structured?
So it is indeed. So there's different clients to structure different ways, but most of them end up sharing in the sales.
Okay.
So that's why the influencers love it. It actually accomplishes one of the goals of advertising law, which is if you're an influencer, you actually have to use, like if you're a celebrity, you have to use the product, which now they're clearly using it because they're live streaming it or they're taking a photo with it. It used to be, it was kind of difficult because just being a cutout, cardboard cutout was very difficult to ascertain whether you drove that car. And so it actually solves that problem. And the third one is it actually sets a tone for Western brands to look at, actually, even performing in China or what we should be demanding in the West, which is, influencers shouldn't be so high upper funnel. It's CPM based, essentially, or cost per impression, if you will, or cost per acquisition of like or share. It should go all the way down to how many people are shopping through their Instagram, how many people are going to their accounts to shop, how many affiliate links are you generating on Amazon for us? If we could only do that, and we're observing China's going to start leading the way again in terms of advertising agencies now writing rule books, and we're writing rule books on how to regulate influencers. Not only from a cost perspective, that was long, unlike in the US where we have a long way to go to even regulate the costing of different influencers and evaluating their cost. We've already regulated that we have a platform called CAPE that has a transactional database of all the influencers. But you've also got the issue of just how are they selling? So you make a content creator essentially turn into a what they're supposed to a really good marketer.
Wow, fascinating! I would love to continue, Humphrey. Unfortunately, we just ran out of time. But thank you so much for coming in to discuss. I just learned 10 new things I didn't know before. So I hope to do it again with you sometime.
Thank you, and thank you for everybody to listening in on my very opinionated comments about the Chinese advertising industry.
The opinionated episodes are always the best. All right, guys, thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.
This episode is sponsored by AdsWiz. AdsWiz Audio Ad Tech Platform is the underlying solution for leading audio publishers across the industry and was awarded Best Publisher-Side Technology by AdExchanger at our inaugural Ad Industry Awards last year. In addition, their audio ad buying platform and DSP, Audiomatic, is optimized for podcast buying and is used all over the world by leading agencies to create entirely new audio ad experiences. Produced by Bigfoot Music and Sound in New York City.